What's the relationship between stopping smoking, weight change, type 2 diabetes, and mortality?
Does vaccination in pregnant women increase the risk their children will have autism?
What about risk factors, cardiovascular disease, and mortality in folks with type 2 diabetes?
And can you treat someone with stroke when they don't know the onset of the stroke?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on August 17th, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we have three from the New England Journal of Medicine this week and one from the journal Pediatrics. And I'm actually going to pitch the ball to you first because you picked this one on prenatal Tdap vaccination and the development of autism spectrum disorders. And I think it's really important from a public health perspective.
Okay, so let me set the stage. Tdap, as you refer to it, is the vaccination against tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis. And the acellular pertussis is for whooping cough. The recommendation is that pregnant women, even if they've received previous vaccination for this, get revaccinated. And the reason for that is whooping cough is very contagious. Infants, particularly in the first 2 months, are susceptible to developing whooping cough and dying as a result of it. Now, there has been some concern that vaccination in the mother actually could increase the risk of autism in their children. Some people think that autism is an inflammatory disease that affects the neural system of the developing child. And if you give a vaccination, that could boost the immune response in the mother and somehow affect neural development. Is that really true? We have a large database from Kaiser Permanente in Southern California where they looked at almost 82,000 children that had been born to mothers during that period, some of whom did receive the vaccine, some of whom did not. And what they discovered is, as a group, about 1.6% of all children born were diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. And by the way, that's very similar to what's described across the United States. But there was no difference between the mothers who received vaccination during pregnancy and those that did not. This should dispel any rumors at all that vaccination in pregnant women increases the risk of autism. It does not.
And of course, this accretes to the whole body of evidence clearly establishing that vaccination is not only safe and is not related to autism spectrum disorders, but also is incredibly efficacious in reducing the burden of infectious disease and infectious disease sequela.
Elizabeth, you said it very well. And again, there's been a lot of miscommunication and misperception and unscientific assertions that vaccinations are related to autism. I'm concerned because in many states, children are going to school without receiving vaccination, and it puts them at risk, and also because of the lack of herd immunity, puts other children at risk as well.
And I would say the other thing is, last week we highlighted a study in the New England Journal also looking at pregnant women, and I, for one, am really happy to see this population being studied more rigorously. Speaking of the New England Journal, why don't we turn there? In this study, taking a look at risk factors, mortality, cardiovascular outcomes in patients with type 2 diabetes, I was actually floored. I love these European studies because they're so robust, and of course we know these folks gather a lot of data about their populations. In this case, they had 271,174 people with type 2 diabetes in the Swedish National Diabetes Registry, and those were matched with 1.3 million plus controls on the basis of age, sex, and county where they lived. They took a look at age categories in folks with diabetes, and they looked at five risk factors, and those are elevated hemoglobin A1C, elevated LDL cholesterol, albuminuria, smoking, and elevated blood pressure. And then they looked at outcomes, death, acute MI, stroke, and hospitalization for heart failure. And they took a look also at smoking. Their average follow-up was 5.7 years. And the upshot of this whole study is that patients with type 2 diabetes who had all five risk factor variables within their target ranges had little or no excess risk of death or MI or stroke as compared with the general population. To me, an incredibly powerful message to people with type 2 diabetes that getting those risk factors under control puts them essentially in a normal place with regard to their mortality risk. The one thing that they do offer as a caveat was that the risk for hospitalization for heart failure was higher among patients with diabetes than among controls. And the hemoglobin A1C outside the target range was the strongest predictor of stroke and acute MI, and smoking was the strongest predictor of death.
So, Elizabeth, this is really important news for the 28 million people in the United States that have type 2 diabetes, because generally we tell people for those that have diabetes, their risk of death is 2 to 4 times higher than it is in the normal population. I say the risk of death, the risk of premature death, I should say. What this study suggests is if we control the risk factors, especially in younger individuals, we can cut that risk down to the normal population.
And as you've noted so many times when we take a look at so many of these risk factors, all of them are modifiable.
They are, Elizabeth. Looking for a hemoglobin A1C less than 7, getting your blood pressure down, stopping smoking, controlling your cholesterol, and avoiding kidney injury. All of those things are avoidable either with lifestyle changes or sometimes with medications, usually the combination of both.
And I'd like to take home for this for folks with diabetes to be, hey, you can do this. You can reduce your risk of excess mortality by modifying these things, and it's in your hands.
In fact, I'd say even if you don't have type 2 diabetes, these ought to be controlled.
You got that right. Let's pitch the ball back to you again in the New England Journal of Medicine. We've had a lot of really positive outcomes relative to stroke when interventions such as going in there and retrieving the clot surgically are employed. But those have been limited to a window, a certain window, when we know that the stroke has taken place within a certain time period. But this study looks at that a little more carefully.
You want to take the artery that's been occluded and open it up as quickly as possible to restore blood flow back to the brain, because if that's done within 4.5 hours of the onset of stroke, the people are more likely to have complete neurologic recovery. What do you do when someone wakes up with a stroke? They can't tell you whether it happened within the last hour or two or 4 hours or 6 or 8 hours. What this study did was said, if we take these individuals that were not able to date the onset of the stroke and do an MRI, look for specific characteristics that indicate there's a portion of the brain that's received inadequate blood flow, but it has not yet died. And if we take those individuals and give them thrombolytic therapy, can we improve their outcome? Now, this study originally was intended to have 800 patients, but because of lack of funding, it only enrolled 503 patients. Half of them received thrombolysis and the other half did not. In follow-up at 90 days, those that received thrombolysis had a much better outcome without neurologic deficit. About 53% of those individuals who received that therapy did well as opposed to 42%.
What did they use for the thrombolysis in this study?
They use a medicine called Alteplase, and it's routinely used. Now, the only downside to this medication is it increases the risk of having intracranial hemorrhage. Now, that's true even in individuals in which we know the onset of the stroke as well. So that's not any different. The major advantage is for individuals who would not normally qualify for treatment, if the MRI suggests that, in fact, they would receive a benefit, they do.
Good news in this expanding window for stroke treatment. Once again, public health message, if you think you have a stroke, seek treatment. It's better to be wrong and feel a little silly than to have the sequela of stroke.
And not only seek treatment, but seek early. You're more likely to have a better outcome the earlier you receive treatment.
Okay, so let's turn to our final one still in NHAM. This one entitled Smoking Cessation, Weight Change, Type 2 Diabetes, and Mortality. And a lot of this, of course, having to do with these ongoing concerns that if you quit smoking cigarettes, are you going to gain weight? The answer to that is usually yes, unfortunately. And then what happens with regard to type 2 diabetes? Are you more at risk for developing it? And this study says, well, yes, you are, right? But what about mortality? And that says, no, you're not going to have a problem with excess mortality. This is kind of an interesting study. It actually takes a look at those three faves of all of ours, the Nurses' Health Study, the Nurses' Health Study 2, and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. So data from all of those studies. Basically, the risk of type 2 diabetes was highest or higher among recent quitters than among current smokers in this huge data set. The risk peaked 5 to 7 years after quitting and then gradually decreased. There was a temporary increase in the risk of type 2 diabetes that was directly proportional to weight gain, but that attenuated over time. And then finally, I love this phraseology, and I'm interested in your response to it. Quitters did not have a temporary increase in mortality, regardless of weight change after quitting. I thought that was a really interesting way to take a look at this data. So the upshot is, of course, that if you're a smoker, regardless of whether you're concerned about weight gain, type 2 diabetes, and increased mortality, it's still better to quit smoking.
This is a study conducted in about 3.5 million individuals. This is pretty robust. What they suggested is you decrease excess mortality by about 50% by stopping cigarette smoking. And by the way, it doesn't matter whether you gain weight or not, you still receive a benefit. And that's really the most important message.
Here's just one more piece of evidence that it's the right thing to do.
So which one are you going to highlight on the blog?
I think I'm going to do the prenatal Tdap and autism spectrum disorders. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.